The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Our guest today is an English Conservative Party politician, life peer and academic. He was the Minister of State for Universities and Science from May 2010 until July 2014. He has been a visiting professor at King's College London since 2014 and became a member of the House of Lords in 2015. Good morning, I'm Brian Fernandez, and with me on the Breakfast Grill is Lord David Willetts, former UK Minister of State for Universities and Science. We will be speaking to Lord Willetts about his role as a minister, politician, his life after politics, as well as his recently published book, A University Education, where he offers enlightening insights into higher education in the UK. Welcome to the Breakfast Grill, David.
Good morning. Hi.
David, in 2012, you raised tuition fees for UK students from £3,300 a year to up to £9,000. What was the thinking behind the move at the time? Because it was a very unpopular move.
Yeah, it was controversial, but it was also the right thing to do because public funding for universities was being cut back and we needed to provide universities with more revenues. And the best way to do it was for students to bring the money with them in the fees. But unlike, say, in America, the students don't actually pay the fees up front. The government provides them with the money as a loan, which goes straight to the university. And then as the students graduate, if they're in well-paid jobs, they repay the money back to the government.
So what's the means test in terms of repaying the money back?
What you do is you pay back at the rate of 9% of your earnings, but above a high threshold, which used to be £21,000 a year. And actually, the government has just put it up even further to £25,000 a year. So it's like paying back through a higher rate of income tax when you're above a very high threshold.
But David, now, with the benefit of hindsight, do you regret this decision? Because didn't that just widen the inequality in the UK between poorer students who probably then opted for cheaper courses?
Well, fortunately, it had exactly the opposite effect, because when governments are funding universities out of public expenditure, the way they control public spending is by controlling the number of students. And we used to have an allocation, a government allocation of places for UK students at universities in Britain, university by university. Of course, there were no number controls for overseas students. But for British students, there was a limit. As a result of taking higher education out of public spending and funding it in this way through these loans, the government no longer has any need to control public spending. It's not public spending. So we've got rid of number controls. So there are more places at university. And those extra places are often going to students from disadvantaged backgrounds. So since my changes, we've actually seen an increase in the proportion of students coming from poor backgrounds.
Was that the right decision for the UK as a whole?
I think it was the right decision because it's meant that we've got more money coming into our universities. They've actually got more money from domestic students than before. It's meant that, of course, the students aren't paying up front. It's a graduate repayment scheme. And it's meant that there are also, at last, British universities competing with each other directly for students because we've got rid of the number controls for each university. So it's made the system more competitive. So although it's still controversial back in Britain, I think it's actually delivering for students and for universities. Of course, you can always improve it and you can review it and look at ways of reforming it. But I think the basic principle of graduate repayment is right.
David, let's take a look at your role as a minister in David Cameron's government. You were a minister at that time in David Cameron's government's road to the EU referendum. Can you give us your unique perspective as an insider on what was the prevailing opinion at the time within government with regards to the referendum to leave the EU?
Well, of course, that's a very good question, Brian. Of course, I had left the government in 2014, left the Commons in 2015. But I think the background was this. British politics, especially conservative politics, had become obsessed with Europe. And often, other problems in the country were blamed on Europe, I think sometimes unfairly. A lot of people were saying, we've got to leave Europe. The only way to solve our problems is to leave Europe. David Cameron wanted us to stay in Europe. And what he hoped was that by calling the referendum and then, as he expected, winning the referendum for Britain to stay in the EU, he would resolve the issue for a generation. It would be clear without doubt that Britain was staying. Of course, that's where the plan went tragically wrong. And actually, unexpectedly, the referendum was lost. Britain voted for Brexit. And so we've ended up in a path which is very different from the one that David Cameron intended when he called the referendum.
Did he miss the signals from ministers and MPs who were getting feedback from their constituencies that they were going to vote to leave the EU?
Well, when the referendum was called, there was a general expectation that it would be won by the Remainers. And it was only on the night of the referendum victory, I think, that for the Brexiteers, that a lot of people finally caught up with what was happening in public opinion. If you look at it now, you can. I say that there were two crucial groups that between them led to Brexit. One group was the people, the excluded, people whose living standards had not been increasing, people who were taking out their frustrations that their wages were not rising. That's one group. But that on its own isn't a winning majority. The second group were the insulated, older voters in particular, maybe no longer in work, so no longer with their incomes coming through pensions, often protected against inflation. So for them, the exact performance of the economy didn't matter so much, and they voted on cultural and identity politics. If you put together an alliance of the excluded and the insulated, you can get to the 52% which Brexiteers won. So I think that's the backdrop to it. And of course, it was very much the opposite of what David Cameron wanted, and he didn't feel he personally could manage the process of Brexit. So he stood down, announced straight away he was standing down as Prime Minister.
Now, is this also because there's rising inequality in the UK in terms of incomes?
Well, I now chair a think tank called the Resolution Foundation, which looks at this. And although there are a range of different measures, I would say actually in Britain there was a surge in inequality in the 1980s. Associated actually with a general increase in living standards, Britain has not become significantly more unequal since then. Indeed, one of the effects of the crash was the financial crash 10 years ago was that bankers' bonuses fell. So people right at the top, actually, if anything, their incomes fell. So although on some of the measures, Britain is a bit more unequal than some other Western countries, the inequality has not been getting worse. My view is what really matters is here the absolute standards. People in the 1980s would tolerate rising inequality if at the same time everybody was doing better. The real thing, the real problem in Britain is that since the financial crash, on average, living standards have been pretty flat. So people are more resentful of the very well-paid and the rich if their own incomes are not rising. And it's that fact that wages and living standards have barely increased for the last 10 years that explains a lot of the discontent behind the Brexit vote.
You know, you're the executive chairman of the Resolution Foundation, and they put out a report actually saying that the UK's wealth gap had widened. The government then came back, and this was last year. The Conservative government responded, insisting that income inequality was at its lowest level since the mid-80s. Why is there such a disparate view on both sides of the equation?
Well, there's wealth and there's income. They're different things. On income, it is the case that there was a widening of income inequality in the 1980s. And if anything, I mean, to be honest, it hasn't changed much. If anything, there's been a modest reduction in income inequality. I think the report from my think tank that you're referring to could have been about wealth, could have been about assets. And there is a growing disparity, partly because houses in the southeast have shot up in value. And there's a new form of inequality, which I'm very worried about, and is a big challenge in Britain and some other Western countries, which is between young and old. And in Britain, even if you are quite well paid, if you're in your 20s and 30s, your chances of owning your own home are much less than they used to be. It's the older people who have the assets. So what the government is now trying to do is to spread home ownership again, which used to be a great British success story, but has been going backwards. So it's on the asset side, on the wealth side, there's a real challenge.
David, you worked for Margaret Thatcher during her administration. What was that like?
Well, that was a fantastic privilege. I was only in my late 20s, but I was on her team in her policy unit inside 10 Downing Street, working on economic policy. And of course, then in the early 1980s, when she was elected, Britain was the sick man of Europe. Our growth rate was lower than other European countries. Our trade unions had too much power. Too many of our industries were nationalised. And Mrs. Thatcher was fighting really tough battles to reform trade unions, to privatise, nationalise industries, to get the growth rate growing again. And actually, the story of Britain for the 30 years after that has been a success. I mean, we are, of course, a mature economy. We don't have the dynamism of a lively, developing economy like Malaysia. And it's always great to see Malaysia growing strongly. It's a really exciting place. For us, as a mature economy, raising the growth rate is much tougher. But we did it. And between the election of the Conservative government in 1979 and the crash of 2008, and even up to the Brexit referendum, the British economy was one of the fastest growing of the mature Western economies. My fear about Brexit is that it could change that, but we must hope that the shock of Brexit obliges us to raise our game and do another round of reform, just like the kind of reforms that Margaret Thatcher did so heroically in the 1980s.
David, you were given the name Two Brains while serving in the Cabinet Office during the premiership of Sir John Major. Now, in a 2015 interview with the Daily Telegraph, you were quoted as saying, "Of course, in the Conservative Party, it's a complete disaster to have a nickname like that." So the implication is dangerous intellectual, out of touch with the world. Did that perception of you hinder your further rise in politics?
Well, who knows? But certainly it is fascinating to compare Britain and Germany. And I had a lot to do with Germany, still do, have friends in Germany. In Germany, political scandals are when ministers proudly boast of their doctorates. And it turns out that actually they haven't really got a doctorate. In Britain, there are members of the government who do have doctorates but try to hide it because they're so embarrassed about the fact that this would reveal they were an intellectual. And even on your programme now, I'm not going to reveal the fact that I know members of this government, this cabinet, who do have doctorates.
So David, what you're saying is it's better to be daft as a brush in politics.
Well, there's a strand of conservatism. And look, I'm a conservative and I love conservatism, but there's a strand of conservatism which says that we stand for the rooted, unreflective traditions and instincts of a people. And particularly in Britain, that's embodied in institutions. I think our love of country is not an ethnic blood and soil nationalism. It's a love of its institutions, which should be open to everyone, regardless of their background or race. But there is that kind of feeling. We love these institutions, so we don't actually need to be endlessly thinking about them. Part of life and part of politics is enjoying things as they are. And that is a strand of conservatism, and I understand it. But I've also thought that conservative must always be modernising, must always be adjusting to new circumstances. And that's why one challenge I wrote about before was making sure we're still delivering fairness between the generations, and why the challenge in my latest book, A University Education, published by Oxford University Press, is about how we ensure that our universities carry on being world-class. So you've got to be – it is just like – in this respect, just like running a business, and maybe business leaders listening to this program now, you can't ever just sit back and say, we've got this market sorted, we've got a well-run company. You've always got to be looking at the next challenge coming up and how to tackle it.
I'm Brian Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Lord David Willetts, former UK Minister of State for Universities and Science. In just a bit, Lord Willetts will share his insights into his book, A University Education, and how university education needs to evolve. Stay with us, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
On The Breakfast Grill this morning, we are with Lord David Willetts, former UK Minister for Universities and Science. David, what were your key achievements as a minister?
Well, looking back, on obviously the high point of my time was serving in Cabinet as Minister for Universities and Science. I really enjoyed that. I do think that we put the funding of our universities' teaching through the fees and loans onto a better footing than they'd been for a long time, with more money coming in. I loved being the science minister as well, and as part of that, promoted international links, because science is the kind of subject now which nobody can do just in one country. And indeed, if I may say so, visiting Kuala Lumpur, I created something called the Newton Fund, which was the first time Britain had set up funds specifically for science and technology partnerships with other countries. And one of those partner countries was Malaysia. And that Newton Fund which means that there's British funding and the Malaysian funding going into shared science and technology projects, is thriving to this day, and I'm very proud of it.
What do you think was unfinished business for you as a minister?
Well, I would say that for universities, we need, if anything, longer, broader courses. And so having more four-year courses alongside our classic three-year courses is a challenge. I think for science and technology, it's very important that we apply the scientific research in commercial ways, which is why I'm actually now setting up a venture capital fund to invest in the commercialization of technology. That's a challenge. And then the other bit of unfinished business is this broader picture of the younger generation as a whole needing a fair deal from the older generation. And that particularly in Britain, it means getting more houses built so that the younger generation have the same prospects of being a homeowner as my generation did.
David, your book, A University Education, examines the history of English universities, makes a passionate defence for the value of university education, and an argument that the provision of higher education should be expanded further. Can you just give us a key overview of key issues that you've raised in this book?
British universities have expanded massively in the past 50 years. 50 years ago, about 5% of young people in Britain went to university. We're now just getting up to 50%. And at each stage of this process of growth, people have said, it can't go any further. There's too many people go. We've got more graduates than we need. Well, the evidence which I bring out in my book is actually the British economy has always been able to absorb these graduates. In fact, having more graduates has in turn enabled companies to do more R&D, to go up market, to operate in more sophisticated ways. So there are always the edu-skeptics, the people who say, that's enough education, let's stop. I'm a shameless believer in growth. And one of the things I really like about Asia and appreciate every time I come up here is the hunger for more education in Asia. And indeed, I give the figures in my book that Asia now has more university students than any other continent, far more than Europe or America. And I think that's one of the great exciting prospects for Asia's performance in the future, that it's so hungry for education. And that doesn't stop at 18. It carries on into tertiary education and should carry on through adulthood. We all need to learn new things.
Now, traditionally, Asians have sent, and still do, thousands of students to the UK. Now, besides twinning programs with partners in Asia, UK universities have moved to the next level of collaboration. They've set up branch campuses in Asia. So you have, for example, University of Nottingham, which has sent up campuses in Malaysia, also campus in China. How do you see the relationship changing between universities in Asia and the UK? And how do you see it evolving even further moving forward?
Yeah, well, I think it's great we've got British universities with campuses here. And indeed, I visited Nottingham University's Malaysia campus with your Prime Minister, the Malaysian Prime Minister, and the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, just a few years back. And I think we will see increasingly universities operating in different, operating across continents, or perhaps forming something more like kind of airline alliances, linking up with universities in other continents. And then aligning their degree program sufficiently that someone doing a three-year course in physics or engineering or whatever can do a year in Malaysia and a year in the UK and perhaps a year in Australia or Germany or US or somewhere, and it add up to a single degree because the higher education courses are interlinked in that way. So I think, actually, those type of processes, globalization, have still got a long way to go in higher education. Again, the figures are, it looks as if perhaps 2% of all the university students in the world are actually studying outside their home country. For most other key industries and business sectors, we've got far more than 2% being bought. More than 2% of motor cars are bought from an overseas company. More than 2% of holidays are taken abroad. So I think that there's going to see a big increase in university students wanting that experience of going abroad. they may well want it connected to an institution in their home country as well.
Now, that's also linked to the evolution of technology. Now, technology is disrupting higher education massively. So you've got companies like Coursera who offer online courses such as MBAs right down to specialist courses that are skills-based. Schools such as MIT, Stanford and Wharton have come online as well, and they're blue-chip universities. They've put curriculums online. MIT's curriculum online is free. How do you see this impacting higher education moving forward?
I think the online revolution will have a big impact, but that transition to adulthood for an 18-year-old, that experience of going away from home to university, meeting new groups of people in a different environment, I think that transition to adulthood is one which will include the physical going to stay at a university. They may have some of those courses in turn accessed online, but then they'll want to go to a seminar, meet a professor, meet their friends and discuss it. And that's why, you know, Malaysian students are incredibly welcome in the UK. It's great that Malaysian students come to the UK for what I think is a worthwhile education experience. And actually, I want to see more British university students with the opportunity of studying in Malaysia, as they can do when they come from Nottingham or Heriot Watt. So I think there will still be that appetite for a university education in a place. However, if you're a bit older, if you're a mature student, if you've already got your degree, perhaps you're married, you've got kids, you've got a job, but you need to carry on studying, or you want a master's qualification, something like that, then I think the online courses are really important, but you need to have at the end of it a credential that is recognised by employers and is valuable in the jobs market. And the trouble with some of these MOOCs is you don't get a credential like that at the end.
But with the greater access to course materials and online learning from blue chip institutions, then what is the role for the local Malaysian university then and the academics?
Well, there are several roles. One role is simply interaction with fellow students and with academics. Another role is to credentialise, to check, to establish that that person at the end of their online course has indeed achieved a level of understanding. And it can be the obvious, crudest way of doing that is providing an exam with integrity that vouches for the fact that you have completed this course and are capable of completing the following exercises in exam conditions. There are things like credentialising and shared learning which are valuable and often best done in a local university, even if a lot of the education materials are quite rightly available online.
David, can you share with us your vision in terms of what universities can offer us now and in the future?
Well, we haven't really touched on research yet, but I see universities as now key to innovation clusters, which must be the future of the Malaysian economy, the future of the UK economy. In the old days, dynamic economic clusters were located around natural resources, mines, ports and harbours. Increasingly, they're now focused on high-quality, research-led universities. That's what attracts smart people. That, in turn, attracts businesses. So having world-class universities doing world-class research is crucial for an economy. We're very fortunate in Britain. We've got a lot of those sorts of universities. And in Asia, there's a real hunger to develop them. And I think Malaysia has got fantastic potential. It's a centre for higher education. It's a hub attracting universities from around the world. It's a free society with lively debate. So I think for Malaysia, as for Britain, in research-intensive universities doing cutting-edge innovation is very important. And secondly, yes, that challenge of online learning, blending the online experience with a real experience of getting to know academics and friends in a university setting. Those are two really exciting challenges.
David, it was a pleasure having you on The Breakfast Grill. That was Lord David Willetts, former UK Minister of State for Universities and Science, and you've been listening to BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.